like to take a look at Ahuna's wonderful, inspiring art, you may do so by logging on to either Amazon.com or FineArtAmerica.com. And, of course, Ahuna is also involved in all kinds of other marvelous activities, including reading of the Akashic Records. And right now, Ahuna and his wonderful associate, Kevin, are speaking to me from Ireland. And this evening, we're going to be talking about the mystical sites of Ireland and how they interrelate to other mystical sites. And sadly, this evening, we won't be able to take questions and comments from our call-ins because we are doing a little pre-tape from Ireland because the time difference is pretty profound. So without further ado, I would just like to give a very, very warm greeting to Ahuna and Kevin, and thank you both so much for joining me this evening.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, speaking all the way from the 40 shades of green to Canada.
Oh, how lovely. I can only imagine. And tell me, it's my impression, of course, every time I've touched down in the homeland, that there is, in fact, a very, very special vibration about Ireland in general. It is even distinctly different from the British Isles, the rest of the British Isles, I believe.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. And for people who were born and reared here, it's like you get too used to a good thing, and we don't really appreciate the extent of that energy until you're away for a while and you come back, and then it really, really hits you. And for many visitors to Ireland, especially Americans who are retracing their roots or picking up soul pieces, as would be familiar to a lot of the Native American Indian tradition, they actually recognize that energy. They recognize that their heart or their soul or some part of them is still here.
Oh, indeed. It's resonating, and I believe it probably is resonating right in the soul path, you know?
Yeah.
The whole energy, the whole beautiful, beautiful transformational energy. So I would love to just touch a bit on a bit of Irish history for those who are listening who are not really perhaps as familiar with the extreme ancient history of Ireland. And now, of course, in the case of Scotland, I believe it was settled, was it not, by the Picts and the Gaels, who were both Celtic tribes. So the actual formation of Ireland as a country or as a region, how was that formed?
Well, now, before we get into that, Leslie, let me introduce my old friend Kevin O'Kelly. And Kevin O'Kelly, who's here beside me, is going to answer that question for you. But let me give you a little bit of background to him, because he's a very modest guy, and he won't tell you a lot of this himself. But he's a big, burly man who kind of looks like that
Grizzly
Adams character. He's a full-faced beard. But he is renowned for his pilgrimage tours of Ireland. People come from all over the world, and he takes these people on the tours of the sacred sites, the monasteries of Ireland, the energy points, all over the country. And he is a wealth of knowledge. And it's why I brought him in this evening, because this man will answer all those questions with a story attached to them. So he's not only giving you the historical facts, but he has yarns and stories which will entertain our audience for several days, let alone the next hour. So here he is,
Bill Kelly. Hey, lovely. If only I was sitting in a pub with you guys right now. Well, I am in my mind. I am in my mind. I'm having a fabulous pint of Guinness right now.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking out the window at the glorious landscape as we do.
So gorgeous, Kevin. Thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us on the show this evening. And I'm just so pleased that you're able to chat with us. And I know you did hear my earlier question, and perhaps you'd like to maybe address that about the deep history of our native land.
Well, it does go back a bit. In fact, it goes back so far, we're not even too sure who's involved in the early stages. What's known is that there were various different stages of invasions, really, probably could call it, where, first of all, there was Partholon, a Greek guy who arrived here way back when. There was another group, the Milesians. Then there was the Firbolg. the Tuatha De Danann, and finally the Celts. And there were several different waves of Celts arrived. But each of the previous couple of groups actually had something very particular that they brought about the spirituality of the land. There's some kind of a, I don't know, what would you call it? There is a mystery and a mystical essence to the land of Ireland. There's something about walking through the mists and walking over these gently rolling hills. Ireland has some of the oldest mountains in the whole of Europe. You know, places like the Alps are big, tall mountains and craggy ones. Irish ones look much gentler, they're much smoother, but that's because they're so old. And they've been trodden for, oh, so many centuries now that it's a very ancient landscape. That's probably one way of describing it. But certainly, the people that occupied Ireland before the Celts, the Tuatha De Danann is the name in the Irish language. And that really means the Tuatha is the people of the goddess Danu. So there was still an essence of a feminine in the divine that was represented here in the landscape. And that was represented in the rivers and the mountains and the valleys. And you know, there was just that sense of there being something more to life. So that really was what led up to the arrival of the Celts. But then when the Celts arrived, there was a very interesting little war where the Celts and the Tuatha De Danann divided the land between them. They eventually came to a truce. They divided the land between them. Anything above the ground was occupied by the Celts, and anything below it was occupied by the Tuatha De Danann. So nowadays we sometimes call them the little people. And you hear people talk about the fairies and the leprechauns and various things like that. Very mythological type creatures, but there is some kind of a reality to it as well. There's that essence of what lives below the ground and what pushes up the crops that grow and the fields that sort of nourish the animals and nourish us as well.
Yes.
So there's something of the cycle of life that's built into this mythical story of the origin. It's a kind of a creation story in a way.
Yes, it is, and it's amazing how many creation stories of Aboriginal peoples do involve some type of duality between the beings that exist below the earth and our organic nature-based elemental beings, and the later arrivals who live above ground.
Yeah, now one of the things I have to say that I really like about the later sort of cultures and spiritualities that emerged in Ireland was that they didn't submerge that completely. They didn't completely take it over. They absorbed it. So a lot of the current like public holidays and things, even Christmas and various different festivals like that, are very much based around the old Celtic year. In the US and Canada, you celebrate Halloween. Now, that's an ancient Celtic feast. That was the turn of the year, in fact. The year in the old Celtic calendar changed as we were going from summer into the time of darkness.
Yeah.
Not in the depth of the winter, it was the going into the darkness consciously that was an important thing. And then you go through the whole time of darkness. There's the time when the sun changes its direction and then it starts to emerge. It's a festival on the 1st of February, there's another one on the 1st of May, and then another one on the 1st of August. So that's what we celebrate today. Mm-hmm. So you're actually celebrating the feast that's known as Lunasa. And right out the window from us here, there's a mountain that's named after the god Lu, as in the festival Lunasa.
And Lu, was he not sort of a Bacchus-like character, a god of wine and dance and joy?
There is a certain amount of that we still like to absorb and keep as part of our national character.
No kidding. And I believe would it not also be traditional at the festival of Lunasa to have bonfires and other kinds of things that we would associate with the more recent Halloween or All Hallows Eve?
Oh yeah, very much so. The bonfire that started the night before, it was on the eve of the feast day. You know, the start of the festival, it was like in the old Jewish tradition, where it's the eve of the festival. The sun goes down, it's the start of the new day, it's the start of the new feast. So you celebrate with the bonfires and the letting go. And you know, to this day, there are some of us who perpetuate that kind of thing. And on days like today, in fact, it would have been yesterday evening on the eve of the first that we would have been doing this, had I not been doing busier type things, where we would actually celebrate with various different forms of bonfire. And one of the things that I started doing at one stage was going around the farm that I live on, gathering up some of the old sticks. And then when we gathered together for the bonfire, at a certain stage, we deliberately, consciously throw onto the bonfire the stick with whatever cares and concerns and worries and things that we wanted to let go of. Okay. And we'd actually be saying, you know, with this dead wood, I give to the fire and to the divine. And then you'd name what it was you wanted to let go. And then you'd let it be burnt up in the flame. And then you'd be getting on to the next stage.
So it's a purification ritual. And of course, you know, and I was raised as a Catholic, so I'm not digging at anyone in particular. But then with the, shall we say, the massive PR campaign of, you know, oppressing the Irish people with Catholicism. As you said earlier, so many of these traditions were embraced and actually have their origins, their deep origins in the Celtic or pagan history.
Yeah, it certainly seems to me that early Christianity, when it arrived in Ireland, saw something in people's search for the divine that was already here and said, ah, we have something to contribute to that. And that there was a coming together of the traditions. You know, that even the Trinity, when St. Patrick, you know, the shamrock is a very famous Irish symbol, and that comes from St. Patrick using it as a way of treating what he understood of the Trinity. But well before that, there was a triple-headed goddess in the Irish culture. And that this was representing three aspects of femininity: the maiden, the mother, and the crone, or the wise woman.
Yes, the wise woman. Indeed. And in fact, you know, this marvelous acceptance or aspect of the sacred feminine is, you know, always in my mind been part and parcel of the Irishness that I feel. And certainly, according to the work of some scholars, such as the late Zachariah Sitchin, and other people who are able to read the ancient Sumerian scrolls, the materials such as these, there is a tradition that deep in the prehistory of Ireland, some of this megalithic structures such as Carnac and some of these other locations in Ireland were in fact put in place and established by a extraterrestrial being who was a member of the Anunnaki, who in fact traveled from what we would now call Lebanon to the British Isles, and specifically to Ireland. And of course, at that time, there is some speculation that Ireland, in fact, may have been a tip or part of the great Atlantean continent that then stretched in the other direction all the way to, you know, Bimini in Florida and those areas.
There is so much that is unknown about that whole area. But what we do know is that there are so many things in Ireland that were put here so long before the Celts, that the Celts arrived in Ireland about 500 BC. But the likes of Newgrange were actually built several thousands of years before that. So we don't know who those people were, because they were here for a while, they built some amazing things, and then they went. They left again. We don't know where to, but there's a gap in the history then after that.
Indeed. And what does Irish legend say about the builders of the megalithic structures? Is there a mythology in place? Do they speak of gods and goddesses? Or what is the general idea that of what may have happened?
Yeah, I'll pass you back to Ahana. He's got a few interesting thoughts on that.
Oh, excellent.
Well, we're noticing an interesting change that's happening with the tour guides in Ireland, because we visited one of the oldest buildings in maybe in the world, certainly that we know of. It's like something like 1,500 years older than the Great Pyramids of Egypt, of Cheops in Giza, which is Newgrange. Now, we were there yesterday and we toured around the place. But we've done it many, many times because it is a place of high energy. It's connected through ley lines to various other buildings around the place. But it seems like the story that the tour guides give is changing over time. In other words, they used to tell everybody that these were built by primitive people, farming types, hunter-gatherers, and they just had no understanding at all about how these huge mounds were built and how they carried these huge stones for many, many miles and how they constructed them at all. But now their story is changing, where they're beginning to understand them as being temples, and they're beginning to see a correlation between their position on the landscape and the correlating stars in the sky. So the picture is beginning to open up to a lot of these geologists and people who are interested in the sacred sites.
Indeed. And may I ask, are the stones themselves of a special, unique composition? And the reason I ask is I haven't been fortunate enough to really visit any of these marvelous sites in Ireland, but I have been to Stonehenge in several locations similar to that. And the stones themselves, I mean, myself and also my sons, I could feel a resonant electrical field on the stones that was palpable. I mean, I don't think you have to be particularly sensitive. To me, it was so strong and so profound, I don't see how everybody couldn't sense it. Is there that same type of unique composition of the triptychs in Ireland?
Yes, very, very much so. And in so many different places as well. And this is Kevin back again. The place Ahonu was just talking about in Newgrange, which is a very odd name, calling something the whole a name that says Newgrange.
The irony, yes.
It was found in an area that was taken over as a grange or an outlying farm that fed a monastery. But the monastery was built very recently. That was only the 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the whole Brúna Bóinne complex, and there are several of these tombs in that area, or what are labelled now as being tombs or passage graves. Personally, I think that they're much more important than that. These days, people will bury people that are important to them in churches or graveyards around churches, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the reason that the church was built. And I think the same is true of a lot of these ancient sites, that they're built because they represent or they capture or they embody a particular energy. And some of them are very distinctive, and sometimes it's very closely allied with the orientation. That particular one that Ahonu mentioned now, Newgrange, that faces the midwinter rising sun. So for a few days either side of Midwinter's Day, but then particularly on Midwinter's Day, the sunshine comes in through a roof light and right up along the passage into the middle of the tomb. So that just on those particular days in the year, this entire chamber is illuminated from outside. Mm-hmm. And for the rest of the year, it stays completely dark.
Interesting.
No. If somebody who's a dowser brings in either rods or a pendulum, it'll go crazy in a place like that. It just spins. The energy is so powerful. Mm-hmm. But we also have a lot of standing stones that are isolated on their own, and then there are stone circles. Now, it's very, very hard to date these. It's even more difficult than with the likes of Newgrange. And some of those are also extremely powerful, that there's energy vortices that are based around them. Particularly there's one in a place called Kenmare on our west coast, and there's a big stone in the middle of it, a flat stone, almost like an altar, and then there are surrounding stones, and the energy vortices in that are exceptionally strong.
And certainly, I mean, one could speculate that these particularly salient, these nodes, these areas of the ley lines, when they cross these particular areas, I mean, it's certainly possible that space-time, in fact, there could be a certain point in space-time where perhaps even some sort of travel could be involved.
There have been various different theories about that, and even sort of ways of working with changes in the laws of physics. There's one rather extraordinary lady who's no longer with us, she died some years ago, who had a book that she called Time Travels of an Irish Psychic. And in that, she went along to some of these sacred sites, went into a meditation, and asked the stones to tell her about their history and how they got there and what they did. And she came up with some extraordinary images of particularly moonbeams, for some reason, being used to move stones. Now, I have no idea what the technology behind that was or how they did it, but certainly she was saying that it was done by a very few people, not a huge community. And that they move these stones, sometimes over great distances. You asked about the composition of the stone itself.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes there's a variety of stone in these places. Some of the ones that can be carved a bit more easily have been brought from, let's say, Dundalk Bay was one. Now, that would be maybe about a 30-kilometre journey, which, you know, 5,000 years ago, 5,500 years ago, looks like it might have been, you know, quite a haul.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the other stones, now particularly that Newgrange place, it's faced with quartz, white quartz, and that would have been brought from the place where we're sitting at the moment in the Wicklow Hills.
Well, the quartz was certainly any kind of crystal composition would certainly be significant as far as amplifying any kind of existing earth energies that might be present.
Yes.
And we do see that in pretty much every sacred site around the world, mm-hmm. from Angkor Wat to Baalbek, and in Lebanon, and I mean we see that crystal composition even in Asheville, North Carolina.
That's right. Indeed.
They have a phenomenal composition of crystal, and so this is something that we do see. Now, tell me, Kevin, how do you perceive, or do you perceive the presence of elementals? Are they still, in fact, inhabiting some of these sacred spaces? Is it possible to interact with elementals, either telepathically or in some other way? And are they benevolent in general? Because there are some, the folks here in Canada and Newfoundland, they have their own version of fairies, which are pretty malevolent picture of a being, you know, but yet in Ireland, mostly what we hear about are benevolent aspects.
Well, mostly that is the case. Like, there are a few who would look at the likes of leprechauns as being a kind of a trickster kind of an energy. Uh-huh. But that trickster can sometimes have a malevolent streak. You know, we wouldn't treat leprechauns lightly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They'd certainly be regarded as quite a serious sort of a trickster. But most of the energies in the land are not only sort of benevolent, but outwardly moving benevolence. You know, that there is there is a kind of an outreach in it, that there is something that wants to reach to people and leave them transformed and touched by the energy and the essence of place. That there are so many sacred places in Ireland that a lot of them are named after the monasteries that Christian saints built there.
Yeah.
But they were sacred places long before Christianity ever arrived here. Mm. There is that kind of a spark or an energy in so many of these places. But it varies so much in character. You know, as you travel down through the country, or east-west through the country, you'll find that in the west, where there's limestone karst as the main topography, that there's a craggy rockiness. And in a place like that, you sort of sit on a rock on the top of a mountain and let the wind blow through you. And the divine speaks in that. And you
Indeed.
Can feel the presence in the rock around you as you do that. And it's extraordinarily supportive. There are other places in the Midlands now that are much more lush vegetation, the greener places. And the fertility of a place like that is extraordinary. You know, to sit on a rock there, if you can find one without the moss on it, is an extraordinary essence of sort of being surrounded, being hugged by the trees and enveloped by the mountains.
You know? Just the absolute overwhelming vibration of growth and lush greenery is part and parcel of the fairies and the little people, because they are in between. They're somewhere in between what we would call vegetation and a humanoid type structure. And let's see, what was I? Do you think it's possible that that fairies and leprechauns and other elementals are able to phase in and out, in a sense, that they can also manipulate space and time?
Well, there are particular times when we feel very much closer. You know, those particular times now that I mentioned earlier, the times of the feast days and the bonfires and things like that, we call them the thin times, when the veil between the worlds is very thin.
Yeah.
And there are particular places that are thin places. And again, for the same reason. Like, there's a place called Glendalough that's only a little bit south of us here, a few miles. You can walk to it from where we are at the moment. And that is one of those places that, even though it's visited by thousands of tourists a day, that if you go in the early morning or late evening, you can feel these other presences. And only once or twice when I've ever gone there has there been a sense that the energy is saying to me, no, Kevin, not today. This is our place today. And that is always at those times of transition. You know, if I go there at Halloween, I may or may not be given permission to go into the place. And the sense is that, no, we're doing something. This is our place tonight. Now, yeah. We don't come here. There are also places that are dedicated like that. Some of the small little stone circles, there would be a great sense that you people do not go into them.
So you simply, you approach with respect and sensitivity, and then in that way, your relationship with the elementals would be unpolluted and undisturbed if they are approached with that respect that they so much deserve. And are there in fact fairy circles? Tell me a bit about fairy circles.
Well, this is a Hanu, and before I pass the mic.
Oh, Hanu, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll pass the mic back to Kevin to answer about the circles. But if I just wanted to comment about how tangible, how real that sense of the presence of those elementals is, that indeed the Irish Tourist Board, this would be a department of the government, actually recognised a park, a side of a mountain really, about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours north of Dublin, almost close to the border with Northern Ireland, where they actually conduct tours and games and so on to actually seek out leprechauns and fairies on the side of the mountains. That's actually a tourist attraction, a recognised tourist attraction. So I wanted to mention that it's not just something that's airy fairy with the people in Ireland. It's something that's tangible and something that's very real. And as you may know, my wife Angie Rose, she actually sees them and feels them. And it was one of her delights when she first came to Ireland to be able to be in the presence of that energy. Now there's also another very, very realistic aspect to these energies, and that is that the farmers throughout the island of Ireland, they recognise the importance of not disturbing the various mounds where these elementals live. And I remember quite clearly several times when I was growing up where a farmer took it upon himself to actually take a digger and level one of these mounds. And within days, the guy was dead. And it wasn't just coincidental. It has happened numerous times throughout my lifetime. But it's also in the psyche of the people. So it remained undisturbed for hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of years.
Indeed. And, you know, I should maybe mention that I believe it's possible to see, perceive, and communicate with elementals really anywhere. And in my own garden, I'm quite a gardener, in my own garden, I have seen small beings, often just represented, I often see them only in light forms. I don't know quite how to describe it. Not really fully physicalized, but I sense them as if I was just seeing the aura part. So that's the way that I have been able to perceive them. And I ask them for help with my garden. And, you know, I don't have any, I don't use any insecticides, I don't use any of that stuff. I don't have one insect in my garden that's causes problems. And, you know, last year I was growing zucchinis that were, and I kid you not, about 4.5 feet long. There is such a thing as too much zucchini. but I do think that I think the elementals are certainly based, you know, their home base is Ireland, but I think they're all over the world, and you can actually communicate with this more subtle world if you just let yourself be quiet for a minute.
Yeah, most Irish people would be aware of the sense of their presence rather than actually seeing them. There is something about relaxing into seeing them that is possible as well. Just to look at a landscape that is so familiar and let your eyes see differently. And then you'll see the sparkle on the leaves or the twinkle on the lake that is more than just the trick of the light.
And, indeed.
That's the start of being able to see. We're so conditioned to almost block out all the advertising and the media. So many things are trying to grab our attention that we have built-in filters now. And to spend time pilgriming, spending time walking through the landscape, spending time letting go of your own thoughts and just being one with the land is a wonderful, magical way to get much more in tune and then to start perceiving. And then you start realizing that, well, actually, it's not just that we need to respect the earth. We are one with the earth, and these creatures remind us of that too. Mm-hmm. And it is that sense of the oneness of all that is that really pervades everything. So then the variation of the different creatures and the different elementals and all the different forms we can see these forces and beings in starts to fade a little. And there's just this incredible sense of the oneness of everything.
Indeed, that is true. Now, the pre-Christian religion of Ireland, can you describe it a bit? Was it a ritualistic religion? And again, we touched on this a bit when we were talking about Lunasa. Were there gods and goddesses? Were the gods and goddesses worshipped? Were there sacrifices? What was the structure of the most ancient religion practiced in Ireland?
Well, you know, we're really only trying to piece together the bits as we come across evidence. You see, it is so far beyond history that we actually don't know. Irish history wasn't really written down for many, many centuries, but there was a tradition of poetry in which the poetry was held in such a strict meter, you know, the rhythm of the words, the rhythm of the sentences and all the rest would be so strictly defined that if anybody changed, if the poem was handed down from generation to generation, if anybody changed even a word, it would be spotted straight away. So there was this way of handing on the various different stories in that form of the song or the poem. And even to this day, the poet is a very highly regarded person in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. The greatest writers that the world has ever known all come from Ireland, if I may say.
Well, you know, part of that is that there is that contact with something that goes a little bit beyond ordinary everyday life that is in that life of the poet in Irish. And it is a wonderful language. It holds meaning in a way that's very different to English. It's a very richly layered, it's a deep language. In a lot of ways, it's closer to Sanskrit than it is to English.
Indeed. Okay. It's ancient in the extreme. And of course, it is all but obliterated for a time there. In other words, you know, my grandfather did speak Gaelic. And however, certainly not my parents. And you know, it was in the process of being completely, you know, nearly completely obliterated in my grandfather's time. But I understand now that there's now a resurgence, and that our children now are being taught their original language in school.
They are. Now, for a long time, they were forced to learn it, which was very unfortunate because people have a way of rejecting things they're forced to do. But now there is a love of the language emerging simply because it's such a beautiful thing. But one of the things that gets back to what you're talking about the structure of the old religion, is that the names of the places in the old language are very often linked to the roles that it would have had. Or like the Lum na Quilla, the mountain that's just south of us here, that is the one that is named after the god Lu. Lum na Quilla is Lu of the forests. So he was the god of the forests. Now, that whole essence of the calling the trees as being sacred things is built into that. Now, it was a druidic religion, and it said that the first thing that the druids had to learn when they were training was the names of the trees. Now, that's not just the taxonomic label like we have in English. To know the name in certain languages is a much deeper thing where you start to know the essence of the tree. You know, and to this day, you know, there are people who, you know, if you get a fever or if you have a pain or something like that, there's a particular drug that can be taken to do that that comes from the willow tree. The bark of the willow tree gives us aspirin. You know? And there are various other things like that that would have been well known back then, that there was the medicinal properties of the trees, there's the essence of the strength of various different trees or the suppleness of others, and all of these were characteristics that were valued very highly. And that was built into the structure of that religion. Now, we know that there were druids who had a priestly type role. They represented something of the sacred. They held a lot of the wisdom. But there were also the kings. And in Ireland at one stage, I think we had something like 153 or 155 different kingdoms. There's different accounts of that. It's not just that my memory's gone. But all of those various different kingdoms had ways of linking in with the kingdoms around. So, for instance, we do know that that one king would have several of his children looked after by the neighbouring kings, and he would be looking after several of their children as well, as a kind of a system of hostages, if that's not too strong a word for it, so that peace would be maintained, so that there was this good linkage between the various different kingdoms. So there was a political structure as well as a spiritual structure, and the two seemed to work very well side by side. And of course, then there was the role of the bard. The druid was the person who had that priestly role, but the bard was the one who had the stories of the people. That was the person who would keep people awake at night by singing songs around the fireside with the harp, or whatever other instruments that they happened to have at the time as well. And but to have the stories of the people in the form of song was something that was just about as sacred as knowing the trees.
You know, it just is so, everything that you're saying just resonates so strongly with also other Aboriginal cultures, the Native American religions and their oral traditions, and the importance of singing and containing their history in song. It's quite fascinating. Now, you mentioned earlier, is the Gaelic language, or the group of Gaelic languages, they're sort of their own thing. Are they in fact related to Sanskrit, or what is the origin? If they're not European languages, they're not Asian languages.
Well, they are actually related to Sanskrit. Put it this way, there's probably a root language, an Indo-European root language that would have given rise to Sanskrit would also have given rise to the Celtic languages, which would have come westwards across Europe and eventually arrived in Ireland. But when the Celtic languages arrived, and interestingly, being a Celt is not a racial thing, it is actually a linguistic grouping rather than a racial grouping. No. So when the Celts arrived at Western Europe, having travelled from the East in various different places, they divided into various different groups, and the languages evolved. And there are two major families, now we call them the P-Celts and the Q-Celts. For example, the Welsh are part of the other group, not the Irish one. And I can't understand a word that the Welsh say. On the other hand, the Scots have a form that is very closely related to Irish. And if they speak slowly enough, I can understand them perfectly well. So really, there's Irish, and there are various different dialects. The Northern Donegal dialect is quite distinct from the Connemara dialect, which is distinct again from the Munster dialect. And then there's Welsh, of course, which is next door. There's Scots. But travelling further south, Cornish is being reinvented. It died out about 150 years ago or so, but it's been rediscovered. It had been written down, and people are trying to work out what the sounds would have been, and they're starting to learn to speak it again. And then there's Breton, which is the one that is around Carnac in northern France. Around that particular area has a very strong linguistic and beautiful musical tradition. And then on the northwest coast of Spain, there's a little Celtic outcrop in Galicia.
Galicia.
Oh yes, and that's a wonderful place. And Galician is another language that I can't understand that one unless they go extraordinarily slowly. But it's still very distinctively a Celtic language.
Indeed. Well, there are dialects of in the eastern Canada, you know, Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. There are dialects of Gaelic spoken there that have long died out and are not even spoken in Ireland anymore. So they are also, you know, quite ancient in the extreme. And it has a musicality that's incredible. Now, was there in the deep history of Ireland? Some of us are. Well, in my family, we're all blondes and redheads, but the indigenous, the earliest people of Ireland, were they blonde and redheaded, or is this something that was introduced with the arrival of Scandinavian DNA? Because I understand that the Welsh people, the indigenous Welsh people, are quite small and dark.
And a lot of the earlier Irish would have been that, and I probably once upon a time have fitted into that myself, but the hair has gone a bit whiter in recent years. But remember that the different groups that I mentioned now, that before the Celts arrived, there was the Tuatha De Danann, but before that again, there was the Fir Bolg. Now, the Bolg is a satchel, and the Fir Bolg is the men of the satchel. Now, there's a couple of different ways of interpreting that. Now, some of us are built in a rather, shall we say, ample fashion. And we would sometimes translate that as being the Belly People, which interestingly travelled into Europe and is now known as the Belgians. You know, there's very
interesting.
Yeah. So the various different ways the populations mix throughout Western Europe is quite extraordinary. But that would be one of the roots. So the shorter, stocky, dark-haired strain is definitely still here. And even in my own family, there are several of us who are the tall, fair-haired, slimmer build. And then a couple of us who are the sort of the stockier, dark-haired, thick-set people. So, you know, they're still very much the same kind of thing.
Yes, so it is a mix, and certainly the Scandinavians were in there somewhere. I think they did a genome study of the Orkney Isles at one time, and very recently, a few years ago, and they determined it's something like 80%, 90% of all the males tested were carrying Scandinavian DNA markers.
Oh, the Vikings were the most extraordinary people. You know, there was a particular type that came raiding down as far as the Irish coast. They didn't always bring the highest of Scandinavian culture with them, shall we say. And they certainly have left certain genetic traits in their wake. The distinctiveness of the Scandinavian look would have been absorbed very much into the Irish culture. But the Irish culture was always one that absorbed others. You know, that when the Scandinavians arrived, they arrived and they were a superimposition on culture until gradually, bit by bit, they became part of it. And now to this day, even things like the best of the old Viking longboats that's now preserved in Denmark.
The
Sea Stallion, that particular boat was actually made from timber that was cut only a few miles from where we're sitting now at the moment.
Oh my goodness.
So there was a huge integration of the Scandinavian and the Irish at various different stages.
Yes. And perhaps even silversmithing, it's speculated, because of course we're known as marvelous makers of silver ornamentation and gold ornamentation, and that metalworking, it's speculated, came from the Scandinavians, or maybe the Scandinavians got it from the Irish, I don't know.
There are so many.
I like it that way better.
It's hard to try to figure out. A friend of mine who's very much a metallurgist actually found in South America that there were certain bits of metalworking techniques going back many, many centuries that actually linked in with the ancient Irish techniques. And he wondered whether, or what you mentioned earlier about Atlantis, was actually the case, whether there was some kind of an intervening landmass where people had actually been able to travel between the two countries, because the particular form of alloying metals that they were using was found in those places and nowhere else.
I have no doubt that I think the evidence is actually is overwhelming that there was in fact a landmass and in fact free trade. And we see all kinds of things we would consider anomalous. They recently found high levels of cocaine in Egyptian mummies, and it wasn't cocaine that was used as a preparation in the burial, which was speculated, because they also found nicotine. But in fact, they know from how the cocaine was absorbed that it was ingested, and the only place where coca leaves, of course, grow naturally is in South America. So it's a mystery.
Well, we certainly, when we discovered things that some of the dyes in the very famous Book of Kells were ground up lapis lazuli and things like that at the time were only found in Afghanistan.
Indeed.
They emerge in Irish manuscripts. No, at various different stages there was a lot of international trade.
There had to have been, and in the antediluvian world, you know, before the melting of the ice caps, before the last ice age, the land masses were all different, and I believe that, as we mentioned earlier in our chat, many of the sacred sites, if not all of the major sacred sites globally, are located on the same latitude. So there had to be a unification of thought about that, and it has to be significant as well as far as ley lines and natural power points in the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, there are various people here who have been doing studies on the current structure of those lines and looking back. And there are several people getting into paleoastronomy, and they're looking at the alignments of the stars, the alignments of the planets, as they would have been 20,000 years ago or 30,000 years ago. And they're finding that it would be radically different to what we're seeing now. And that some of these ancient structures, the likes of Newgrange and things like that, actually make a lot more sense when we look back at the ancient astronomy rather than just purely interpreting it by the standards of what we see in the sky at the moment.
Indeed, indeed. Tell me, in Ireland, have there been crop circles? Has there been any of that sort of activity going on in Ireland as it is in Britain?
We've come across very small amounts of it. But it hasn't been well documented, and it certainly is nowhere near on the scale of places like Wiltshire.
I see.
I'd have to say no, not as much. A sense, in Ireland, the sense of the sacredness of the land has never been submerged as much as it had been in parts of England. My sense would be it's needing to make more of an effort to come back over there than it is here.
Mm-hmm. And also, Lindsay.
I wonder. Go ahead.
Lindsay, yeah. Also, we have to remember that there is a school of thought that these crop circles are formed by two drunken louts who come out of the pub and stamp down the corn and the oats and the barley and so on. And
there is that theory, that possibility.
There is that theory. But the guys here, they wouldn't waste their time. They stay in the pub.
My father mucking about, pushing down somebody's field.
That's right. Now, can I say, just for the benefit of our listeners, you can understand listening to my good friend here, Kevin O'Kelly, what a mine of information he is about the landscape, the culture, the religions, the people, the languages and everything about it, so much so that people come from all over the world to follow his pilgrimages around the country. And we have worked together to put together such tours, and if any of your listeners want to go to mysticalireland.holistic.ie, they can actually find out the details of such a tour that we're actually putting together for next year. And I'll spell that out. It's Mystical Ireland, that's all one word, mysticalireland.holistic with a holistic.ie. And you get details there of the extent of the various types of archaeology, mythology, religion, what else do we include? The sacred sites, language,
fairy king,
culture, the fairies, Irish music, everything, a mix of everything thrown into that tour, which is nothing short of memorable, really.
Oh, marvelous. And I will be putting up this information on our website, lightworkhypnosis.com, and that information will also be available in the show description for tonight's show, Sunday. And I hope to join you next year.
Oh, we look forward to that. We do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, it's just about time for us to sign off, but I want to thank you both so much for joining us on Contact this evening, Ohanu, and of course, Kevin O'Kelly, my countryman, and you folks have all heard about the website to check out for one of these fabulous tours, which I think everyone should do, whether you're Irish or not, it doesn't matter, you're going to feel Irish by the time you're done, I would imagine.
That's right,
that's it.
And who's to say that if you're carrying some Irish DNA, it's some of the most ancient on the planet, and any little bit that you are carrying will be reactivated you take this fabulous tour.
That's right. And we get people to taste a pint of Guinness, too, and that will cement the relationship.
It will indeed. It will indeed. Well, thank you both so much, gentlemen, for joining us tonight on Contact. And I look forward to meeting you both in person not too long from now. And also, I will be enjoying this marvelous tour next year for sure. And if anyone would like to address any questions specifically to either Ahonu or to Kevin O'Kelly, are there email addresses that you would like to give us today if someone has some specific question about something we did not cover?
Okay. Well, Well, my one is kevin@o-kelly.com.
That's marvelous.
Kevin at O hyphen, that's the minus sign, kelly.com. And?
Yeah, that's easy to remember. And my own is ahanu@ahanu.com, and that's easily spelled also. It's A-H-O-N-U @ahonu.com. And that mysticireland.holistic.ie is the web address of that sacred sites tour pilgrimage that we'll be doing early next year.
Marvelous. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, and may the road rise up to meet you.
And may the wind be always at your back. Thank you very much, Leslie.
Many blessings.
Thank you so much, and have a marvelous evening, and I charge you both to drink a pint for me, okay?
Certainly will.
Well, with pleasure.
Lovely. Look
forward to seeing you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
She was very good questions, didn't she?
Yeah, she was great.
I must admit, I started thinking when she was starting to get into more of the elementals, this should be a three-way.
Oh, I know.
I know, yeah.
You know, you see them better than most people, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm really aware of them, of course.